Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. Final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic, Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And if you are a Facebook user, you can find the Patriot Journalist Network on using the Facebook search engine. Just type in Patriot Journalist Network as one word, and you will find this show, but not only this show, you will also see Mark Prasik's show, which is Full Armor, which you can find Monday through Friday evenings from 8 p.m. till midnight Eastern Time, and it is a live video chat. And so tonight we will have a very special guest. We have the privilege to interview the Constitution Party's vice presidential candidate, Jim Clymer. Now, the Honorable Mr. Clymer will address the same topics and questions the Democrat vice presidential candidate and the Republican candidate faced in their October 11th debate, and we will hear how the Constitution would be used to solve the key issues of this country. And right now, I do have one of our panelists on the line, which is Chris, and I see another member of our panelists has called in as well, which is Kelly Mordecai. Kelly, we will say a brief hello, and then I believe we have Mr. Clymer on the line. And I hear him typing in the background, so I will proceed. Yep, okay, he's typing. Perhaps we'll bring Kelly back in, but at this time, okay, it sounds like you muted it, so we won't have the background noise, which is good.
I'm here.
Hello, Kelly. Okay, great. Okay, well, after
hey,
time up. Go ahead.
I'm so looking forward to this.
Great. Yeah, as are we all. So, and without further ado, I believe I'll be bringing in the Honorable Mr. Clymer. Yes, so this is Mr.
Evening.
Clymer. Good evening.
That's me. Good evening. How's everybody doing?
Good, awesome. Sir. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well, I think. I guess we're missing the big debate this evening.
Well, the circus? I mean,
the circus. Well said.
trust me, we'll get it ad nauseum, you know, for the next 3 or 4 days. It'll be, you know, it reruns again on CNN in a few hours, so I can sit down and force myself to watch it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much how it is. As you know, we would just watch it just for, I couldn't even say educational purposes, just purely for that we can glean some questions from it to ask some real candidates such as yourself and hopefully at another time, Mr. Goode.
Yes, well, good. And thank you. Let me say at the outset here, thank you for having me on, and it's always a pleasure to work with people who believe in the Constitution and want to see it upheld and restored to governance. So I appreciate what you guys are doing, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much, and I say we will just get straight to it. And we will begin with the first question that we've seen on the presidential or vice presidential debate, and that was we begin with the Libya question. On the anniversary of 9/11, Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed in a terrorist attack in Benghazi. The State Department has now made clear there were no protesters there. It was a pre-planned assault by heavily armed men. Do you think this was a massive intelligence failure?
Well, yes. I mean, I think you got to say it was a massive intelligence failure. You wonder, and of course, the difficulty of answering this question is having heard not only and watched this debate between Biden and Ryan, but also here having heard this topic beaten about in the second presidential debate as well. I'll try to keep it on focus here, but one can't help but wonder how they didn't know this was happening, and to be so misguided as they were, and they're so eager to blame it on the video, the YouTube video that was circulating, and of course, it turns out that had virtually nothing to do with it, that this was truly planned terrorist attack. It was a gigantic lapse of security. Of course, they had, and it's even since the last debate, even in the last week, there's more information has come out about how Ambassador Stevens had been asking for more security and was suspecting things were getting worse and was being put in a more dangerous position. And, you know, asked for more security and he didn't get it. I mean, despite the warning signals, it was just not only they were misguided and misinformed, or I think it was probably more a case where they were just ignoring the clear signs that were out there. Now, all this, however, I think sort of misses the point as to why it happened. And, you know, I think there are significant, serious policy issues that are involved in all of this apart. But that's not part of the question, so I won't get into that, I guess. But the answer, I think, is very simple, that yes, indeed, it was indeed a massive intelligence failure.
I want to ask you so bad right now about the other policy, the failure of policy issues, and I kind of have a feeling where you're going to go with that because we've interviewed you before. But we've got several of these have Middle East topics to them, so maybe what we can do is we can get the questions out of the way, and then we can expand on that. How's that sound?
That's fine. You can drive wherever you want. I'll try to follow.
I think you can handle us. So, number two, let's move to Iran. No, I don't want to move to Iran. It was said that Iran is the biggest national security threat this country is facing. Both President Obama and Governor Romney have said they will prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, even if that means military action. Former Defense Secretary Bob Gates said a strike on Iran's facilities would not work and, quote, could prove catastrophic, haunting us for generations. How effective do you think a military strike would be?
I suppose a military strike could be very effective if we unleash all the power that we have. But again, that begs the question of whether we should be engaging, we should even be talking about a military strike. You know, if we have to reexamine our entire policy in the Middle East, in my view. And every place we go, we mess things up. We make things worse. I mean, and we, by going in there and flexing our muscle, exerting our power, we do things, we mess up the status quo, the equilibrium that exists, and end up hurting those people that we should be protecting. I mean, look at Saddam Hussein. It was, for all the things you could pick about him and make him look bad, which, of course, the Bush administration did, the fact is that he was one who protected the right of Christians there. And since he's been deposed, the Christians have been enormously persecuted. You see the same thing happening in Libya and Egypt. And, you know, when we go in there and decide that somebody's bad all of a sudden, and in many cases, of course, it's people that we supported for a long time before that, and then we come in and decide they're bad, and we help to get them deposed, and we increase the power of the Islamic radicals, and we hurt the Christians that we should be wanting to help. And I think we risk doing the same thing in Iran. I don't see, somebody would have to convince me that Iran is a real threat to the United States. Oh, it may be a threat to our oil interests, maybe a threat to some of our economic interests in the Middle East, but I fail to see how Iran is a real threat to the United States, and I just think we ought to keep our nose out of the business there. It's not necessary for the strategic defense of our country and our people to tell Iran what they can do and what they can't do.
I want to spin off this one, Robert, real quick, because this he opened that door to the issue of, do you think that our plan around, because see, nobody in the Western news wants to cover, you have to go overseas to get decent news coverage on what's going on in the Middle East. And, you know, we've got this three-point environment with Russia and China on the back end of these countries, and we've got a war by proxy already going on in Syria. And so I often wonder, especially with all the things that we've learned, you know, thank God for the internet, that we've learned in the last 10 years about every game we've played in foreign countries around the world, you know, especially with the Cold War. You know, we had so many different, you know, wars by proxy against Russia, the communists in those days. And I'm wondering if people really realize what's really going on behind the scenes, because we're getting ready to end up in a war with China and Russia. Do you have any input on that?
You mean because of what's happening in the Middle East, or just part of the total?
Yeah.
Yeah,
just part of that whole total game that's going on over
there. Well, I think that could very well be the case. And again, I think it's a basic policy failure where we're flexing our muscle, engaging in conflicts that we have no business in, and it goes back to, let's follow the Constitution. You know, the Constitution doesn't authorize the president to be engaged in military operations around the world like this without a declaration of war. If Congress looks at it and decides that, whatever the case might be, whether it be Iran or whatever, Congress lays the facts out, looks at it, and determines, yes, this is a serious threat to our country and to our borders, our citizens. We need to go after Iran or whoever it may be, and so issues a declaration of war, then let the responsibility lie on the shoulders of the of the Congress and let them make that decision and do it, but not have a dictator or a strong man president going around the world and calling the shots like that. Because I think that's how you get involved in the broader struggles. That's how it starts out with something like in the Middle East, which in the total global perspective would seem to be relatively minor. But when you have China and Russia having interests there, and by sparking a conflagration of some sort there in the Middle East, that it could very well spread out, and we find ourselves in a global war of immense proportions with China and Russia. So that's a risk you run by involving ourselves in military conflicts where we have no business.
Very good.
It's speaking in those terms, we'll go on to the next question that was there that night. And it brings up Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, say that three times fast, guys. Held up a picture of a bomb with a red line, and talking about the red line being a timeline as a spring. Now, what he was alluding to this as a timeline as to when Iran will be at 90% completion to having a nuclear bomb. The question was, can you solve this, and what I mean by you, a good climber administration, and if a good climber ticket is elected, could you solve this in the 2 months before spring to avoid an Israeli attack on Iran, or avoid nuclear proliferation?
Well, again, I'm sorry, but I reject the premise of this. And just because Netanyahu holds up a timeline like that doesn't mean it's a fact. And I guess I would also say, even if it is, does that pose an immediate, an imminent threat to the security of the United States? And if it does, then it gets back, bounced back to Congress and let them evaluate it, hold hearings, do whatever they need to do, and decide whether something needs to be done militarily in the form of a declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Israel has atomic weapons. You say, why shouldn't Iran? Or who are we to say that Iran shouldn't have atomic weapons? Well, you know, this thing can be debated back and forth over and over again as to whether
that is true.
How close they are to having it, and I don't know. I mean, what? I don't not privy to that information.
Right,
but,
and I know one of the arguments is, well, a country like Israel and the United States would not use nuclear weapons as a preemptive attack or preemptive strike on another country, whereas there was the fear. That or the concern that after some of the comments by Iran, you know, we're talking about Ahmadinejad, that they would use a preemptive strike against another country with a nuclear weapon.
Yeah. And, you know, there may be some legitimacy to that. I don't know. I mean, you have a schoolyard bully, and they can talk big and do a lot of blustering, and that's a little bit the way I view him. And maybe you're never sure whether he's going to follow through or not, and maybe that's a legitimate fear. But on the other hand, we live for, 30, 40 years during the Cold War, where a lot of people felt that about Russia, or the Soviet Union, I should say. But they may well have used it preemptively. And, you know, basically it wasn't a very pleasant way to live for us, but we still live with that threat of nuclear power being unleashed on us with that fear. And, of course, I don't suppose any of you guys are old enough to remember back in the 50s and 60s when people were building bomb shelters and the public buildings had bomb shelters in and all those things. because it was a very real fear during the Cold War that we could be attacked with nuclear power. And I'm not saying that we deal with that in a cavalier manner, that we say, well, you know, we did it, it happened before, it can happen again. But on the other hand, until Iran has missiles that are capable of coming to our shores or appear to be developing missiles that have that capability, I think we need to be very careful about how we get involved with it. And I think Israel is very well prepared to protect itself. I don't have any problem with selling weapons to Israel. I don't have any problem with giving them our... I keep one... The easy term to remember is Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative technology. I don't have any problem in selling that to them if they don't already have it. And there are ways of deterring mad men who, and of course, Ronald Reagan, I think to his credit, used that understanding in helping to bring the Cold War to an end. And I think that Israel has done a pretty good job of taking care of itself, and I don't think that we have to be in there inflaming things, inflaming the whole region with our military might when they're quite capable of taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm. And they do have the second most powerful air force in the world, for one. And so that kind of moves us to the next question that was on the debate that evening. And what would you, they were asked, and so we asked the question to you, what would you consider worse, war in the Middle East between Mideastern countries, another war in the Middle East using our forces and treasure, or a nuclear-armed Iran? Of those three, which would you consider worse?
Well, you don't welcome any of those. I don't know that I'm prepared to say which is the worst. I'm looking for the question here, and I'm
number four.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want. You certainly don't want all-out war, and you try to avoid it. But you look at the reasons for why it may be. And I guess I'd have to probably say that all-out war would be the worst. Just the fact, some of the other stuff, you know, it's speculative. And if Iran has a nuclear bomb, while they may be dangerous, it doesn't mean that it's going to be disastrous. It doesn't mean it's going to be used. We want to try to keep the peace. But again, we don't keep the peace by going in there and inflaming things. We don't keep the peace by attacking Iran. We don't keep the peace by moving our troops in or our air force in or whatever the case might be to try to enforce it upon them.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. It's such a muddled situation. That's kind of a trick question because it's kind of like they're saying, okay, pick the lesser of three evils. Which one is your favorite pick? It is kind of a trick question. Number five on that list was...
Well, and that's one that she asked, since we're covering and responding to the ones that we did on that night, so that's why I had it in there.
I know, it's a hard one to answer, you know. I mean, yeah, it's almost ridiculous. But next question, state of the economy. The number one issue here at home is jobs. The percentage of unemployment just fell below 8%. For the first time in 43 months, the administration had projected that it would fall below 6 after the addition of close to $1 trillion of stimulus money. Can you guys get unemployment to under 6%? Biden said he did not know how long it would take, and Ryan alluded to another 4 years if he and Romney were elected. What's your input on that?
Well, one thing we know is that what they did didn't work, and I was opposed to the stimulus. I was opposed to the bailouts and all the things that they did. You know, when you're sick, sometimes you just have to let nature take its course and sweat things out, sweat out the disease or the illness, the fever, or the whatever it may be ailing your body. And I think the same thing is with the economy. Clearly, the free enterprise system needs to be allowed to work. We've gotten so far away from that with so much government intermeddling, and of course there are so many strings that hamper the recovery in terms of regulation, in terms of government, again, intermeddling in the economy, that we have a long ways to let it go. I would not be prepared to say that we could get the unemployment back down to 6% in 2 months or 4 months or 6 months or anything like that. But a couple of things that we would be putting in place, a good administration would be putting in place that would help a lot, would be to, first of all, stop the illegal immigration and bring that to a complete halt, and that's going to open up jobs. Deport people who are here illegally. That's going to open up a lot of jobs, and sharply curtail the even the legal immigration. When we have people begging for work here, let's employ our own people instead of bringing other people from other countries in to take jobs away from Americans. And I think that's what's happening. So those are some steps that would greatly enhance the employment rate, I believe, in the United States. And then coupled with that, take the shackles off of business, especially small business, to let them let small business reignite the economy. Cut back on the regulations. Allow them to play more on a level playing field with China and other countries that are undercutting us in manufacturing, and I think that would fill the private sector with a lot of confidence that would end up getting people, small businesses, willing to take chances and take risks in starting new businesses and employing new people. And I think it may take, six months or more or a year, we would get the unemployment rate down to 4 or 5%.
I have a question. Actually, you kind of opened up two questions, but one of the questions, I literally transcribed the third party responses to the second debate and was very interested to hear Mr. Goode tag. You know, I heard him talk the immigration issue, but there was one thing that caught my eye was he was talking about 1.2 million new green cards a year that started with the Bush administration and was carried right through with the Obama administration. Nobody talks about that. That's a lot of people. And he brought that up several times. But the thing he kept talking about was the trade issues, the free trade deals that go on and how they are crushing our industry. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I'm sure I can't state it as well as he does, but he's exactly right. What they do in the name of free trade, in my view, really isn't free trade at all, or it's a misnomer for what is truly free trade. The only way you can have free trade if everybody's playing on a level playing field, and we're not doing that at all. I like to have the emphasis being on fair trade, and fair trade, which doesn't have a lot of restrictive elements to it in terms of prohibiting trade, but provides some assurance that trade is going to be balanced between countries, and that we're going to have equal access to their markets that they give to, that we give to the, them to our markets, and things of that nature. But yeah, the 1.2 million green cards a year, I mean, that's just appalling when we have 23 million people out of work. Why should we be bringing those in?
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's two of the things, especially on immigration, and I'm just going to chime in just for a moment on this, that I do like hearing is that about the green cards, especially, you know, waiting till unemployment is, what, it's like 4 or 5% before ending the moratorium on them.
Yeah.
I almost said memorandum, but I know that's not right, but moratorium on them. And also, I like the idea of getting rid of the automatic citizenship for children of illegals who were born here.
Yeah, birthright citizenship. I mean, that's a perversion of the 14th Amendment. It really was never intended for that. It's something that was a policy that was adopted, and Congress could change that in a heartbeat, and they should. Why should they be given a free ride because their parents committed a crime? And the other thing
that's a good point. I have to admit, that's a good point.
It's just like, you got to be kidding me. Sorry.
Well, yeah, folks are going to think that's now people may accuse, you know, those of us who agree with that as being callous, but I'd have to disagree with that. But we won't go in depth on that unless we have time to do that later. Go ahead, guys.
You know, the other point I was going to make that Mr. Good points out a lot is that, and I had never heard this before I heard him expound on it, but we give out 50,000 diversity green cards each year. In other words, 50,000 people get permitted to come into this country just to fulfill a diversity quota. So, because we want to bring in different people, whether they bring anything, regardless of what they may be contributing. So you have potentially, and I don't know this for a fact, but you have potentially have Islamic terrorists. You have any kind of bad element, just in the name of diversity, allowing them to come into this country as green card holders because they represent something other than WASP Americans or something. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. We should be protecting our people, protecting our culture. We should be protecting, of course, our borders and our country generally. But to allow people like that to come in just because we want to fulfill a diversity quota, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Do you think that these diversity quotas and all these games that they're playing that are crippling our country are tied to all these free trade deals and these things that we don't ever hear about going on from country to country, like NAFTA and Mexico, and then part of that is us allowing people to flock across our borders? And do you think it's that sinister and that ridiculous?
You know, I think it's all part of the whole global mentality, the new world order, if you will, the idea that we are all one big world and we need to all do away with borders, do away with boundaries, and experience other cultures and so on. That's the destruction. That leads to the destruction of a country. And,
right.
You know, again, if you think about what defines a country, it's border, it's culture, it's language, it's ethnicity, it's things of that nature, and when you try to do away with all that, you no longer have a country. And that's the road we're heading down, and I think it's by design. We have the New World Order crowd is actively promoting that because that's what they want to see. They want to see a New World Order, a world without borders, without cultural differences, and with the one world government.
Are these people stupid? I'm sorry. But when I hear this stuff and I look at how complex it is just in a, you know, just take a family. and how difficult it is for people to get along. Then take a neighborhood, take a community. I mean, do they really think they can force people to become some kind of unisect race? I mean, call me crazy, but it just sounds like a real sci-fi concept.
But look, if you come up through the government schools and you're indoctrinated that way, and it's not going to happen in one generation. It's going to take several generations, and it's going to take it's going to take my generation dying off, and probably my children's generation even before they can fully implement that sort of thing. But when they have them brainwashed, they have them taught from little up these concepts. It's going to change the way of thinking, and you know they're going to be accepting that. You know, you have a few pockets of resistance, but of course, with military might, they can squash those. You may say they're stupid, but they're also devious. They have a broader plan. They have a plan that is not certainly not in the best interest of the United States.
Okay, Robert.
Okay, now moving on to Medicare and entitlements. Both Medicare and Social Security are going broke and take a larger share of the budget in the process. Will benefits for Americans under these programs have to change for the programs to survive, and how so?
Well, they're certainly going to have to survive. And, I mean, they're certainly going to have to change or they're not going to survive. And, you know, I'm in the baby boom generation, so another couple of years here and I'll be eligible for Social Security. And this creates a real dilemma for me, quite candidly, because I got to admit, this is no way to get elected but to anything, but it was a misconceived socialist program from the get-go. But
right.
We can't look back. I mean, in one sense, we can't look back, and we can look back and rail on FDR for starting Social Security and on Lyndon Johnson for starting Medicare and rail on them for what the socialism that they introduced this country to in those programs. But the fact is, we have it now. We have several generations of Americans who have grown up and gotten old and who depend on it and frankly have paid into it for a whole lifetime. And I'm one of those. You know, I'll tell you, for a long time I was so opposed to it. I didn't think I would ever take it. But, you know, when you see them taking as much money out of your paycheck year after year after year is what they do, and you realize that, you know, paid into this system, after a while you get the idea that, right or wrong, we need to get back some of what we paid in. But leaving me out of it, the fact is there's a whole generation of Americans who are on the verge of retiring now,
right,
who have paid into it. There's a contract. There's a contract between the American government and these people, and that's got to be honored. But at the same time, there's plenty of time to revamp the system so that the younger generations coming on have options for doing something different. And I don't know what the best thing is. You know, the stock market, but why can't they decide what the best thing to invest it in? And let the younger Americans, and, you know, Romney says under 55, whatever, they have different ages floated about. I don't know what the right age is. That's something that could be studied and determined. But certainly somebody who's in their 20s and 30s now, and I would even say in their 40s, should have the option of a different kind of plan, doing something different where they can direct it themselves, and they can decide
right.
whether they want to invest it in real estate or gold or silver or precious metals or the stock market or whatever. Let them make their own decisions about it, and then let them live with the consequences as well, and take responsibility for it.
Right. Well, Gingrich had a very comprehensive plan. What was the country, Robert, that he was using as a model?
In South America. He's saying the Brazilian model.
They have so blessed much money in those accounts that the government had to open up and allow them to invest in foreign markets because they were swamping the economy with such a cash-rich investment because they privatized. And then there's actually some counties in Texas that have done those programs, I think, and I'm not sure if they were in their state workers or whatever, but they gave people these options. And I know that the Democrats, including Mr. Biden, love to scare the hell out of people because they always point to the current crash that is caused by the Fed and bad government as a reason why those programs won't work. And that could open up a whole different conversation, so I'll go off of that one. But you know, that gets back to the Fed and the games they're playing. But next question.
Yeah, the
next question kind of ties into that one.
Exactly, yes. It still has to do with it. And what would be the specific plan, especially for seniors, to addressing Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare?
Well, when you say seniors, you mean people who are already drawing on it, right?
I would say seniors. Yeah, let me elaborate on that. I would say seniors and they're close to retirement, let's say around 55 to 60 years of age.
Yeah. Well, I think you pretty much have to keep the system intact for them. I mean, I just, again, they're the people who paid into it all their lives and they're nearing retirement. There's not enough time. And somebody who's in their late 50s or early 60s, there's really not enough time to plan, to develop a different plan at that point. Are there too many risks involved in doing it? When you have 15, 20, 30 years or so to do it, it's a different story. But when you only have possibly 5 or 10 years to retirement and knowing the risks of any life, you could become disabled at late 50s or early 60s and may have to be forced into an early retirement, so it may be worse than what you plan. So I think we've got to honor the contract that America has with these people and
right.
Reserve the present benefits for them, for anyone who's, say, within 10 years of retirement age.
Yeah, that's actually kind of what I was going to ask is what specifics would there be in where it wouldn't change for the folks, 65 and over, or if there would be a slight change for those, 50 and what those would be, and would it be like an option for the younger folks to opt out? I mean, because frankly, when I plan for retirement, I don't even plan having Social Security in there, to be honest, I think just plan for not being there at all. Would that be an option for someone to say, I just don't even want to be a part of it at all. I'll just, work on my own investments, my own portfolio, and I'll just leave that out of it.
Well, in the area, part of the country I live in right now, of course, we have a lot of Amish around here, and the law specifically provides an exemption for the Amish from Social Security system, and so they can work without paying in, and they're not eligible to draw on it with it. So, and of course, it has worked quite well with them. And I say Amish, it's not only Amish. There's some other plain sex Mennonites and others who also take that approach, and that really goes back to the way it was 100 years ago when people. When communities, when church people, churches and local communities took care of their own and worked reasonably well when it did that, and until the government came in and decided it was going to be the big daddy and provide services and create dependency, in the process. And of course, once that dependency is created, then people look to government. Government becomes their god, and that's what who they look to for their sustenance instead of their fellow man, for their church group or whoever else it may be. But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is
right.
That's exactly what I would offer. Develop a plan. Something that has to be developed in detail, and I haven't done that yet, admittedly, but I'm sure it could be. Just like they provide an exemption for the Amish, they could provide exemptions for really, I think, anybody who would want to say, listen, I don't want to pay into it. I'm willing to forego the right to withdraw to ever participate in it by making my own decisions, and they should have the freedom to do that.
Right.
I mean, that would be an easy way of doing it. And, of course, the mentality of the big government people is that, well, the average person is too stupid to make decisions like that for himself. We have to, government has to be big daddy to tell them what's good for them, because they're too dumb to know that themselves.
And also right now, that money pretty much just goes into the general fund, and if they allow people to opt out, there'd be so many people who are not contributing to filling their coffers, so they could spend that money on something else. I think that's there would be a resistance to that.
Well, there would be, but on the other hand, maybe it's time to call a spade a spade. I mean, this is they call it an insurance program, but it doesn't work like if any insurance company would operate that way. Of course, the executives would all be in jail because they've been spending the money. They haven't been saving it. They've been spending it. They've been running the general fund out of it, and the trust fund really isn't there other than in IOUs and on paper. And so they probably are just going to need to figure out a way to pay for it out of the general fund as they phase it out. That would be my ideal plan to phase it out and pay off the existing obligations out of the general fund, which is basically what it is anyway. I mean, it's a tax, and it's treated like a tax in every other respect, and let perhaps keep a skeleton of it there for the people who feel like they need to have the government provide a safety net for them and are willing to pay in to it. There may be some people who are foolish enough that they would keep doing that. I don't know. And we have to look around to see what incentives may need to be provided so that there can be some solvency maintained as it continues onward. But, the truth of the matter is there are just trillions and trillions of unfunded obligations there through the pension and retirement system and Medicare and Social Security that dwarf the $16+ trillion national debt that's on the books.
Yeah, I've heard some pretty scary numbers. It makes you wonder if their goal is to crash it, the system, the whole economic system, so they can build a new one. You know, this fiat system has lasted longer than any other one's ever lasted, so you wonder sometimes. on to taxes, our favorite topic. If your ticket was elected, well, it's kind of one of those trick questions, and I know you guys have a different tax plan, but I'll just ask the question, and then you can kind of correct it. But if your ticket was elected, who will pay more in taxes, who will pay less?
Well, I'd like to think everybody would pay less, because it would be our goal. We could start going down the list, and for each government program, each government department agency, we'd want to ask the question, is this authorized by the Constitution? If it's not, we're going to axe it. And Virgil Goode has said on many occasions that first of all, start with foreign aid and how the billions and billions of dollars that we give away in foreign aid, and many of it to countries that don't support us anyway and oppose us in many ways. Cut out the foreign aid. Let's get rid of the Department of Education. Let's get rid of Housing and Urban Development. The Department of Agriculture, I don't see any reason why that should exist anymore. If we cut down the cost of government by two-thirds, which if we get back to truly a constitutional government, it'd only be about a third of what it is now. First of all, there'd be some tremendous savings out there, and I'm sure there'd be some difficult times for the transition, but we'd come out a stronger, healthier economy than what we ever had before, and it would be built on the private sector, on a free enterprise system rather than on government. You know, all the growth, such growth as Obama likes to brag about and Biden likes to brag about, for that they've experienced growth in employment or in jobs, job creation. Yeah, most of that's government jobs. That's the one sector where most of the jobs are being created, not in the private sector. So we need to get back to, instead of having so many government jobs, let the private sector develop a lot more jobs. And now I'm getting off the subject because the question was on taxes. And so, again, I'd like to see that everybody be paying fewer taxes. We'd like to do away with the federal income tax altogether and look at other ways to raise money for the legitimate function of government, which, as I said, would, if we would get back to where we really would like to be, we'd be somewhere between a third and a half of what the government's doing and what it's spending now.
And of course, that's a breath of fresh air.
Bring our troops home from around the world that are stationed all over the place, and we could save a lot in the military as well.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, that's huge. Would you, and this just a spinoff of that, would you go, do you guys propose a flat tax? Or I mean, it'd be nice to get rid of it, but obviously these things that you're talking about when you talk about your vision for the future of this country, you know, nothing happens overnight. So is there a stage step in there where you cut government, do a flat tax, and then go after that 16th Amendment and get rid of the IRS? Is that how you guys have talked about that?
Well, I don't know that we have specific plans for that, but we have the goal, and it'd be a matter of working toward that goal. And yes, it would probably have to be, there'd have to be some incrementalism there. Don't think that you can just stop and turn completely on a dime. I would go along with a flat tax as an interim measure for a period of time as we phase out the income tax. But one thing I know Virgil Good has said he'd be willing to look at some sort of a national sales tax or a fair tax
fair
or something
tax,
of that
right.
nature. I've got personally have some problems with the fair tax. At least it's the way it's structured now. And that's primarily because it doesn't talk about cutting back the size of government. It talks about funding
right.
the government at its present level. And there's nothing fair about a 26% tax, as some people are estimating it would have to be, to transfer everything. So it's got to be coupled with curtailing the size and scope of government, bringing the government back to its legitimate functions. And if that's the case, then I'd certainly be willing to look at some sort of a fair tax.
Right.
But the ideal, and if you read our platform, the Constitution Party platform, you know that what we view as the ideal would be to, first of all, impose, raise money through tariffs and levies and impost duties and things of that nature, and some selected excise taxes. And if that's not enough, if we run out of money, don't have enough money to fund the legitimate functions of government, then ask for the contribution, enforce a state rate tax where each state would pay, would contribute toward the operations of the federal government according to its population. So California, with its, what's it have, 35 million or so residents there, you know, it would pay a tax proportionate to the number of people it has to the whole country. And so,
interesting.
And that's where, you know, because actually the federal government is providing services to all the countries of the union, and all the states of the union, and so they all benefit equally according to their population, and that's the way they should pay for the federal government. I think that would go a long way also towards stopping some of this everybody jockeying to see who can get the most for their state, because when their state has to come and pay for these things, they're going to start asking their representatives, you know, why are you spending that money when we're the ones that have to come up with it to pay for it.
Well, let me that was a great answer, and that was interesting. It's the first time I've heard you guys actually say that about the states contributing. Hold on. Excuse me. The ninth question, even though, you know, you've already answered it, there's a part of the question that is, is good to question. What would you suggest beyond raising taxes on the wealthy that would substantially reduce the long-term deficit? Obviously, you've already answered that question, cut government. It seems to be the only thing that Republicans and Democrats cannot get out of their mouths. But if taxes, you know, the argument between the Republicans and the Democrats is this issue of, you know, the wealthiest paying more and not more. In that revamping of the tax system, is there anything off limits? I mean, you know what I'm saying? In other words, the Democrats think you got to tax to pay down the deficit. The Republicans are saying, you know, they have their argument on both sides. I don't know if that question makes sense, especially with the way you guys think about taxes.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're sort of in a different paradigm altogether,
yeah.
So it doesn't quite fit. But, I mean, this whole thing of class warfare that especially the Democrats use to one degree or another, and the Republicans do as well, it just, it's anathema to freedom, to liberty, and to our American heritage, for that matter. Why should somebody who's successful, who just because they're wealthy, be required to shoulder a much higher percentage of the services that are provided by the government? And if people would view government rather than being a redistributor of wealth, which is the mindset of far too many people, and instead to view government as people coming together mostly in local communities and states to do things which they couldn't do separately, but which benefits everybody equally. I mean, I think we would all agree that some things like roads and, certain services like
right.
that.
Infrastructure.
Infrastructure, right.
Right.
Sewage systems, the local level, water supply systems, and fire prevention or fire departments and things like that. There are police departments. Now, those are things which really benefit everybody, and they're legitimate government services, which people don't mind paying for, I don't think, when they're done in a proper and fair manner. But to have the idea that because somebody is successful, they should somehow be forced to share a larger burden, is anti-freedom. It's anti-liberty. And I would say, I mean, the truth of the matter is Americans are generous people. And before you had the government being big daddy to everybody, you had people who were very generous and would help out with charities and benevolence at the local level and, well, at all kinds of levels, actually. And you would see more of that if you wouldn't have the mentality that the government should be taking care of everybody.
Yeah, the Democrats have done a good job of that, haven't they? Robert, to you. Robert?
Sorry about that. Part of the cuts, would there, real quick, would there be anything when you're cutting the deficit that would be off limits that would not be cut? And then I'll move on to the next question with the defense.
You know, Virgil says you wouldn't cut benefits to veterans, and you know, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think veterans, they served their country, and especially if you're talking about veterans who are disabled because of their service or something like that, I think the country has a solemn duty to provide for them and take care of them. Again, the primary criteria would be, is it doing something? Is the program, is the expenditure something which is authorized by the Constitution? And for anything that's not authorized by the Constitution, I'd say everything's on the cutting table. It's all subject to scrutiny and to being cut. But legitimate functions of government, that there's a broad consensus that the government ought to be doing. I mean, I think there are two questions to be asked. First of all, is it authorized by the Constitution? And secondly, is it what the people want? And there could be things that are authorized by the government, by the Constitution, which the will of the public is that we don't want you to do that. Well, then maybe they ought not be doing it, even though they have authority to do it. So I think that every expenditure should come under scrutiny from those two areas.
Interesting.
Okay. And thank you for answering that question. And then I'll bring on to the next one, which is still relevant. Would a good climber administration increase the defense budget? Would there be any other budgets would you increase? But more specifically for this question, because this is we're having the questions from the VP debate with Biden and Ryan. This is one of the ones they've had about the defense budget.
Yeah. Well, no. The overall defense budget would be decreased under a good climber administration. That I can assure you. There may be parts of the defense budget that get increased, but overall, the defense budget would be decreased. And the reason I say that is because we do believe in a strong defense. We believe, but truly defense, not, you know, so much of what we call defense is actually being spent on things that, without constitutional authorization, misconceived wars and entanglements around the world, stationing troops where they have no business being and where it's not our business for it to be there. All those things would be expenditures that could be eliminated or drastically curtailed. On the other hand, there are some things like our Navy, which has suffered severely over this administration, and even partly under the Bush administration. But there's some things like that may need to be strengthened and rebuilt for truly defensive purposes, where, you know, things, armaments that we need for truly defensive purposes.
Right. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, and on to and next they moved over to the Afghanistan question. And what they've got here is that it was reported that recently we just passed losing 2,000 U.S. troops there in this war. More than 50 of them were killed this year by the Afghan forces we are trying to help. It is said we've reached the recruiting goal for Afghan forces. We've degraded Al-Qaeda. Would you leave Afghanistan now, or can more be accomplished? Two, they asked, is it worth more American lives? Of course, every life is precious. And the Obama administration has set a timeline of 2014 for leaving Afghanistan. Do you believe the setting of a timeline for leaving a country is strategically wise? And wouldn't our enemies take advantage of this?
Well, I think it opens up for them to take tremendous advantage. I mean, first of all, if I'm begging the question just a little bit here, because when I get around to answering your first question, it may be contradictory to this, or may seem contradictory to this, but if you determine that you need to be there for proper military reasons, then you don't name a timeline. You don't say we're coming out at a certain time. I mean, that's just that's military foolhardiness. If you're there for the right reason, I'm not sure at all that we're there for the right reason anymore. I'm not sure if we ever were there for the right reason, but I'm pretty sure we're not there for the right reason now. But again, if you're there for a proper military reason, you don't announce when you're leaving. I mean, that just it makes no sense whatsoever. Having said that, I think Afghanistan is a quagmire, and just like we learned in Vietnam, where we had no real will to win, and of course, different set of circumstances there, but we end up leaving in disgrace. And if we keep prolonging this thing, we're going to leave Afghanistan in disgrace, just like the Soviet Union did back in the 80s and or early 90s, whenever it was that they finally got out, when they learned the lesson. Afghanistan is just virtually unconquerable because of the terrain and all the makeup of the country, and we're just there's no way we're going to, my prediction, there's no way we're going to be able to leave that country with honor or with any kind of victory, with any kind of successful turnover to the government troops. You know, it's not working. It's not going to work. So I really believe the best thing to do is to just get out now. Just, you know, before we make them any more of a mess of things, just get out. And if Congress would decide that there's some threat, direct threat to us, and that we need to stay there, then let Congress make the declaration of war and go in and do the job to the best of our ability, and then get out. But Congress isn't willing to do that. They're not willing to make that commitment. They're not willing to make that determination. So we should get out. We shouldn't be over there killing our people and killing their people without a specific game plan, without a declaration of war.
Okay, and thank you for answering that. We'll move on to the next question. Senior officers were concerned that the surge troops were pulled out, and this is, you know, still with Afghanistan, I believe, during the fighting season, and some of them saw it as a political move. What do you think the reason was for bringing those surge troops home before the fighting season ended? Was it a military reason, or was it a political one, and why do you think that decision was made?
Well, I think it was a political decision, and I just think almost everything over there now at this point is a political decision. It's a political decision to set the timeline, going back to the last question. And it's certainly not a military decision. That's a political decision to say that we're going to be out by 2014, or as Biden's promised, that guaranteeing that we're going to be out in 2014. Well, you can't. Again, you can't say that militarily. That's a political decision, and I think pulling the surge troops out before the job was finished was a political decision as well.
Yep, I agree. Okay, number 13. Let's move over to another one of our favorite places, Syria. It was brought up in estimates that somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 people have now been killed. In March of last year, President Obama explained the military action taken in Libya by saying it was in the national interest to go in and prevent further massacres. Why doesn't the same logic apply there? In other words, they're not using the same reasons in Syria as they did in Libya. So what's your take on that?
Well, I guess I, again, reject the premise. What they did in Libya was not right, and so I'm not saying that they should do the same thing in Syria as they did in Libya, because that would be following a bad precedent. And we're not called to be policemen of the world. We're not called to solve every internal conflict, and as I said earlier in the show, so often we assume that role, we end up making things worse. We end up hurting the people that we are claiming to help, and we're not helping the people that we should be helping, and end up making it worse for a whole class of people. So I think we should just stay out of it. It's not our business, and let them resolve their own issues.
I think I'm agreeing with that more and more and more in my old age. What do you think is going to happen if Assad does not fall? What if he hangs on? What's that going to do to that whole region in there, just based on, what you see?
I don't know what it's going to do, but if we go in and try to interfere, I can almost guarantee it's going to make it worse. And, there are certain things that nature, whether you're looking at nature out in the wild, or if you're looking at kingdoms rising and falling, or tribal units going on the war path, whatever it may be, there's a certain equilibrium that eventually prevails, and sometimes you have to let the process work out in the area, in the community, and in the culture that it's happening in. And again, when we start interfering, we're asking for trouble, and there's just almost a certainty that it's going to make things worse. And
right.
I'm not saying it's going to be good, but why should we go in there and make it worse?
Right.
Stay out of it.
And we'll go on to the next question, which I think staying out of it is a good way of moving into question 15. What are your criteria for intervention? And that's the way it was phrased, but I'm guessing they were meaning military intervention. And would they include humanitarian interests?
Well, it sounds harsh and cruel to say, but the answer is no. I don't think we get involved in humanitarian endeavors. as a nation. I think there are all kinds of great nonprofit organizations that can do wonders and have done wonders in terms of providing humanitarian relief around the world. And I support that greatly. I support it with my money as well as intellectually and emotionally. So there are any number of organizations that do a very good job of that. I don't think the government of the United States has to do it. I don't believe in forced charity. I don't believe in the Robin Hood principle of government where it takes money from some because it has a good deed it wants to do somewhere else.
And that would apply militarily as well. Is that a good assumption that humanitarian interests, that there wouldn't be any like boots on the ground, let's say, if you have, you know, a dictator in a country that is just slaughtering its population, that would not be a criteria, because that would be considered humanitarian interest.
Yeah, that would be. And I, I just have to say it's not authorized by the Constitution, unless they're a threat to our borders, to our country, to our people. There's no authorization in the Constitution for them to do that. Now, a few years ago, of course, you had, and I don't, maybe it's still going, the slaughter in the Sudan and
right.
The various countries in Africa were just horrendous. I mean, first of all, in this, the idea of humanitarian intervention has never been uniformly applied on principle. I mean, when we, you know, if it comes to China, we would never step in. There would just never have been a thought to step in and relieve the people who are being persecuted and killed and slaughtered in China in various ways, or in the Sudan. You know, we didn't feel the need to get in there and involved with that. But then certain other areas of the world, the drumbeat sounds, oh, well, you know, look how terrible this is, and we need to go in here and provide humanitarian intervention. So in terms of national policy, there's never been any consistency. It's just a matter of using the horrors that
indeed
people inflict on their subjects as an excuse for military intervention. And we ought to resist that temptation. We ought to resist that and let organizations, church organizations, humanitarian organizations do the best that they can to stop it and provide relief.
Interesting perspective. I have a movie in my mind, Black Hawk Down, you know, when you were talking about that.
Yeah, right. That's right. Good movie. And I guess the answer to the other part of your question, as far as a criteria for intervention otherwise, it comes back to what I said before. Is the United States of America in danger? Is there a situation that is causing a direct, imminent threat to the security and safety of the United States of America? And if it is, then that would call for intervention. But that needs to be by an act of Congress, not by the act of the president alone.
Very good.
Okay. And moving on to a different topic is, and it's moving on to a very important social and personal issue. What role has your religion played in your own personal views on abortion? And if you could talk about how you came to that decision and talk about how your religion played a part in that.
Yeah, well, and I'll speak for myself and my personal religious beliefs, and which I think are consistent with the moral code that the country has been built upon and which existed throughout our country for 230-some years now. And for myself as an Orthodox Christian, of course, I believe in the sanctity of life. I believe that, that God created us, that we are we have a duty to God, and that that is played out on how we treat the any helpless or hope any helpless elements of society. And that'd be true whether they're it's an unborn child, an infant, an elderly person, or anybody else who can't fend for themselves. I think we have an obligation to protect them. And I think that's the first duty of government, is to protect the innocent and helpless among them, and preserve their rights, protect their rights, whether it's in the first and foremost right is the right to life. So, you know, I don't have some hesitation about melding the religious beliefs with public, with government policy, because, you know, you can get in dangerous ground there. But the fact is that this is a, I think, a part of a broad moral code that, again, was part of the foundation of our country and underlies our entire jurisprudence. And so what I do, whether it's in politics and in developing public policy, or if I were elected to office and discharging the duties of my office, would be would arise out of my commitment to God, my duty to God, and my belief that that I am answerable to God. And and that would affect everything that I do.
That was very good.
Great. And Kelly, are you there? I knew you were working on some grand jury stuff, but if you want to take the next question that I have there, go ahead if you can. And then I know if Mr. Clymer, if you're open and able to stay till the full duration of the show, Kelly has a question regarding, I believe, the grand jury. So is your mic open there, Kelly? You still out there? You still working on?
Yeah, I'm available. I got my hot email out. Let's see. You wanted me to ask the next question, or was there one more on your list?
Yeah, 17. Yeah, there's 17. If you'd like, since you're able to come back in, I put it in the.
I don't know what question 17 is. I'll have to tell you what this hot thing I've been working on. But
let's Rob and I finish these questions and get out of this segment, and then we can open up.
Right, because this next question is also regarding the abortion issue. And so, and in closing out that topic, and of course, if we have time, we can discuss it some more.
There is one quick one I want to ask about social issues. Mr. Clymer there. What? Social issues, we got a whole bunch of them. We had a series on the show here about state sovereignty. My position is that the federal government has no business in the social issues, that it should these should be turned over to the hands of the states. We keep going to the federal government for all our problems. The federal government keeps growing like it is. The Missouri Constitution, for example, they had a referendum that equality of marriage is, they do not allow gay marriage. They do not allow legal gay marriage. Is that also kind of one of the positions you might take as far as all these social issues, letting it back into the hands of the states and the federal government as a hands-off? Is that kind of your thinking in that? Or?
Well, I would probably take make a split decision on that. When it comes to protection of rights, I mean, this was a debate, of course, that took place at the immediately following the adoption of the Constitution and so on, and part of the ratification process. And, of course, that's why we have our Bill of Rights, because they had this dispute is, you know, how can we be assured that the government's not going to be infringing on certain, that federal government's going to be involved in protecting some of these fundamental rights that are so important to us. And, of course, you know, you're familiar with them. The First Amendment rights of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and right to assembly, petitioning government, and all these things. And, of course, the Second Amendment and so on. You know, I, when it comes to a matter of protecting fundamental rights, and believe me, I've struggled with this over the years, but in light of where we've come and looking at the entire Constitution as it is now with the amendments and so on, and I've come to the belief that the federal government does have a role in protecting the fundamental rights. And if I live in Massachusetts and Massachusetts wants to deny me my right to keep and bear arms, I want to be able to appeal to the federal government and say, you know, you're part of this contract, you're part of this compact with the federal government that, and under the federal constitution, the Bill of Rights, you can't deny me these rights. And I want to have the right to appeal to the federal government for protection of those fundamental rights like that. And I would apply that to the right to life, where it's guaranteed both under the 5th and the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So I know Ron Paul is sort of in that way. I'm just not really comfortable with allowing states to, if they're going to be part of the union, and I'm also of the belief that if a state wants to separate itself from the union, it ought to be permitted to do so. But but if it's going to be part of this union, we need to have a certain uniformity, we need to have a certain common protection of fundamental rights, and So if we can separate, when we talk about the social issues, if we can talk about those that affect basic fundamental rights, like the right to life and so on, then I'm not willing to let that totally up to the states. And I'm not willing to let a state deny me my right to keep and bear arms or my right to freedom of speech or freedom of religion and things of that nature. I think there is a role for the federal government to require states to protect those rights, or to protect those rights even if they have to enforce it against the states.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, well, I agree with you in the sense of the right to bear arms, the rights of states' rights and other things, but, you know, the Brady Bill, the federal government was asking, Sheriff Mack wrote about this extensively, I'm sure you've heard of Sheriff Mack.
Yes.
The federal government was asking the counties and states to start rounding up guns, and that's when Sheriff Prince and Sheriff Mack appeared eventually before the Supreme Court and said, sorry, feds, you're out of line in ordering us to do this. And yeah, at the same time, which is a good thing, by the way, and Justice Scalia said, we have a system of in the writings in Prince versus U.S., Justice Scalia said, we have a system of dual sovereignty, states versus federal government, to keep each other in check. And at the same time, for example, Chicago and other cities that passed this no gun law, while the NRA and other groups go to the feds and have to tell a city, hey, you're out of line. The citizens can keep their guns. So I agree with you on some of these basic rights, but some of these social issues, I'm a strong believer in getting the power in the hands of the federal government, particularly because the Republicans and Democrats use it to divide the country and keep most of the people into two parties. They use mm-hmm. these social tools
yeah.
to make sure people are lockstep and either line. But I guess we got to move on to the next question.
And I don't disagree with that. And I think certainly the danger in the history has been that even in the name of protecting rights, the federal government has abused that. The court system has abused that and created and enforced laws or legislated against the states. And now you have, I mean, here in Pennsylvania where I live, We have Section 21 of the Declaration of Rights in the Pennsylvania Constitution is even stronger on the right to keep and bear arms than what the Second Amendment is. But,
wow.
But you know, the mentality here among our state courts is that, well, this issue has been preempted by the federal government. Well, malarkey, you know, that's I shouldn't use a word that Biden used. I didn't mean malarkey, but
that's hilarious.
Yeah. It's stronger. There's no way that the federal government should be able to preempt a stronger protection of a right in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania than what the federal constitution provides for. That's where they should be keeping their hands off of it.
So real quick, so if we could finish the topic out, unless we go later on into the last 30 minutes with it. So would it be safe to say that if the good climber ticket is elected, those who believe that abortion should remain legal should be worried?
Yeah, just like those who believe in infanticide should be made legal should be worried. And I mean, the fundamental question is: the unborn child a person and deserving of the protection of the rights granted or to be secured under the Constitution? And I say yes. I mean, that's. You know, let's say there's a state says, and this is not all that far-fetched. There are some people actually promoting. Let's say, I'll pick on Massachusetts because of its reputation already, but let's say Massachusetts says, look, a child doesn't really have rights until they're at least 6 months old. They've got to be approaching some sort of independence from their mother or from their, you know, attachment. And so they don't really have their right to life until they're 6 months old, or so. Pick whatever age you want, and
right.
And they give you authority of parents discarding of an infant like that, you know. And again, that's not far fetched. People actually have made statements like that. And I've heard people make statements like until they're somehow some viability mm-hmm. on their own, that they're something less than human. Well, you know, people should be worried if they have that kind of a mentality.
Well, and also I also find it somewhat hypocritical, because I know they say, oh well, it's the intent. Is when, let's say for instance, someone kills, you know, or murders a woman who's pregnant, they get charged with two murders. No, I'm
yeah.
for that. I'm for that. I'm glad that they make that distinction. I'm glad that they do charge someone who murders a woman who is pregnant, you know, with two charges, you know, of murder.
Right.
I mean, I'm for that. But for the law, you know, for there to be a law where someone can get arrested and charged and convicted and punished for that, and then turn around and say, however, if your intent is to not maintain that, what they would, you know, not coining a phrase or anything, not quoting, but maintaining a pregnancy status, then it wouldn't be, you know, that's what it turns it into. It turns the pregnancy, instead of, you know, a child being there, it changes it into a status of being or an intent.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there is so much hypocrisy in that whole area. But again, you know, I just think it comes down to the basic question: is it a human being who deserves the protection of the law? And the law does protect an unborn child. You know, you have the right to sue civilly for a child's loss, an unborn child's loss. You have, as you mentioned, criminal sanctions for injuring or killing an unborn child by somebody else, but it's okay if the mother decides to do it.
That, I just want to interject.
Yeah, that's a little bizarre when you really hear it like that.
You got some really good points there.
Okay,
real quick, Kel, I want to just interject while I have it here.
For any of the folks who are interested in this topic and are looking for ways to debate against abortion, there's a great book out that is called The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf, and he spells his last name K-L-U-S-E-N-D-O-R-F. And then once again, the name of the book is called The Case for Life. Go ahead, Kelly. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate this perspective you've provided. And you have some excellent points there. You really do. I'm actually pro-life. Saw a bumper sticker the other day. It's funny, the pro-abortion advocates, when they're not the ones getting killed.
Yeah, right. That's right. I know, it really comes down to, somebody said that the irony of the generation that was so insistent on the right to kill their offspring while their songs are still in the womb is also the generation that may face their
genocide.
Children in their in their later years and deciding that they're not worth keeping around anymore either.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's one I always bring up with people going, you know, especially the baby boomer liberal generation that gave us this insane country that we live in, you know, you're going to be old and unproductive. You think that a society that can kill 4,000 children a day is going to be worried about you when you're no longer productive?
Right.
I'm like, get a clue.
Right, when they feel like you're drained. Well, and you hear that. Because you hear that argument all the time, you know, from people who are pro, I say pro-abortion, I don't even say pro-choice. Because they're like, oh, well, are you going to take care of, you know, that child if it's born? I mean, who's going to take care of it? It's like, and I think that argument that you gentlemen just brought up, well, what happens when you're old and you can no longer take care of yourself? You're going to expect someone to take care of you, are you not? Or are you going to let someone just, you know, put you in a dumpster somewhere and let you die, or they should go ahead and, you know, kill you in some manner?
Oh, they're
well,
going
you can
to
no longer
it.
Take
right.
care
they
of
already,
yourself.
They already do it in socialized medicine countries, and they don't have to. And it's not an act of murder so much as they just deny care. You're not worth this operation, so it shortens your life.
That's right.
You know, whether you have cancer or whatever. People are fools not to think this is impossible.
That's exactly right. And, you know, listen, the truth of the matter is, as long as we've had modern medicine, there's always been people at the lower economic scale had to make those choices. They, you know, the money wasn't there, it wasn't able, they couldn't afford some of the care. So there's always been some disparity between the level of care. But what Obamacare, what socialized medicine does, it brings everybody down to the low level. And so you can't, even if you have the wherewithal, where you want to spend lots of money to try to prolong your life, you're not even allowed to do it. You're prohibited from doing it because they want to bring everybody down to the common level, the lower common level.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get... Let me get this last question in, and then we can chat, you know, because I got some questions below that are a little bit more dynamic. To me, when I listen to these debates, I just go, they're not even covering the issues that need to be talked about, which I'm sure you guys go through every day, too.
Yeah.
But the last question was, oh, my God, it's a long one. Okay. A highly decorated soldier who said that this presidential campaign has left him dismayed. He was quoted as saying the ads are so negative and they are all tearing each other down rather than building up the country. What would you say to that American hero about this campaign and that you can't be embarrassed at the end of the day because you guys don't do this, so the rest of the question really doesn't matter. But, you know, how do you perceive and I'm sure you saw the primary too. I mean, the Romney camp has been a master at destroying, you know, decent people for a year straight. So and
for
now
coronation.
It's Obama and Romney. Yeah, now it's Obama and Romney going after each other. So what's your take on all this?
Well, I think it's a symptom. I think it's a symptom of a disease. I think it's a symptom of a moral crisis in our country. And, if you go into some third world countries or tribal countries and things of that nature where it's survival of the fittest pretty much, and whoever can become the strong man and kill off the opposition, they can rise to the top. And some of the South American dictators, come to power and they kill off their enemies and so on. Well, we haven't quite degraded to that yet, but we do it in other ways. And I think the way they run the campaigns, that's a little bit the way they do it. Instead of, and there are just so many of them. I don't even know where to start, because you have the major media joins in this, and they see it within their power. They have no scruples. I put a lot of blame on the major media, because the establishment media, because they can vilify whom they want to vilify, and they can completely ignore glaring faults in people that they want to promote. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist, it doesn't take anybody with any special abilities to see that the way they treat Obama is so totally different than the way they treat others. And I'm not no fan of Romney, but find a flaw with Ron Paul, and they'll magnify that to make it into a mountain. But something which is truly a mountain with Obama, they'll ignore and pretend it doesn't exist. And so, they have to, well, as you said a little bit ago, instead of dealing with the real issues, they have to deal with these superficial things and get into personality attacks and everything else. And part of me says that's the way they fight. It's like tribal warfare. Instead of killing each other with swords and spears and so on, or guns, as the case might be, they try to do it by character assassination, by destroying them in other ways.
With words.
But it's a symptom of a moral
culture.
Degeneracy. That's the way I see it.
Well, the people buy into it, otherwise they wouldn't sit there and suck it up every day on the news. They give these guys, they empower the major media stations by watching them. I shut mine off.
Right.
I don't let them get my vote.
That'll get mine as well. I mean, I stopped watching Faux News, Fox News, whatever, months ago. And through my general pleasure, I've heard they've lost between 17 and 20% of their viewership by the way they handled themselves in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
Good answer. I appreciate that. You gave it some depth. We didn't know where to go with that one, and you gave it some good response. Kelly?
Definitely good.
Kelly.
You had a grand jury question, and then Chris has a couple himself. Go ahead. So that's the order we'll go.
Let's see. Well, I'll try to make this quick. I was putting out a good fire. This is so exciting. I just got to share it. By now, hopefully, we'll have about 10 complaints submitted to civil grand juries in California asking the grand jurors to recount. I got an email today, and one person that submitted a complaint, and a judge wants to interview him, a county judge wants to interview him to be on a grand jury. In my dream of dreams, he and others start recounting the ballots after the election, a special grand jury convening, and the judge has the authority to do this in California, to actually specifically go after a vote recount. So it was really exciting because I had to get this off to him. His interview is at 3:30 tomorrow.
Huh.
Once he's on the grand jury, I can't talk to him about this and advise him. So I'm very excited at the potential here. Anyway, so I wanted to ask our constitutional friends here. I'm sure you know about the power of the grand jury.
Yes.
Great. One of the problems, this will lead to a question, one of the problems I'm seeing is that we have the right, as a citizen, to submit a petition under, of course, the First Amendment. Petition for redress of grievance. So a petition is, here's a complaint. Well, you can petition the court. You can petition your congressman. You can petition the president. Good luck with that. You have the right to the fourth branch of government, which is the grand jury, as stated by a couple of attorneys. And yet, district attorneys will block this. They literally obstruct the right to petition. And even if they do submit it, they play games, they manipulate. What kind of programs, if you will, would help the American people learn about this and most importantly have access for submitting complaints to grand juries? Because that, I believe if the grand juries were interested by the people, they weren't tinkered with, we would start cleaning house so fast at the federal level, it would make our heads spin. So what kind of things would you promote at the federal level, you and the presidential candidate, Mr. Good? What kind of programs would you guys promote or implementations so that the grand juries can run freely and receive complaints?
Yeah, hadn't thought too much of it in practical terms, it's a bit of a theoretical question because I'm not sure it's really the role of the president to interfere with that. It's a different branch of government. But as we know, of course, the man at the top can influence others and can create a culture and a climate that is conducive for good government in other areas other than what's directly under their jurisdiction. And that's what I would hope and what I would expect from a good climber administration. Your first part of your question about education, we need more people like you out there teaching them. And it needs to be incorporated into the schools. And I don't know that, since I don't believe that the federal government has a role in education, I don't think it's their job to say what has to be taught, but you certainly can use a bully pulpit to tell states that they should be teaching these things. And so much of this is a lack of education in our especially our government schools, where they leave out the important functions of government that have been part of our heritage, part of our Constitution, but have fallen out of favor with the big government crowd.
Yeah, and I think they want the folks to be, and this is just my opinion, but in part I think that they want the folks to be ignorant because they're much easier to control.
Absolutely, no question.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to throw something out. I mean, yeah, education is a hard part. I wish somebody would write a book about the grand jury. Okay, I was just teasing there. All right. But one thing at the federal level with a good climate administration would be this. Appoint an attorney general who would delegate and basically make the practice of the attorney general to get these complaints to grand juries. 18 U.S.C. Section 3332, the federal attorney shall inform the grand jury of a complaint, not just inform, but actually hand it over to them. So as a matter of practice, that's one thing that can happen. The other thing that the executive branch can do is, of course, they appoint judges, lower Supreme Court justices or judges, as well as a few, on occasion, Supreme Court justices.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest appointing judges and justices that know full well the power of the grand jury, and secondly, the necessity of the grand jury.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're going to have to, I mean, that's going to take a big re-education program. I mean, of course, I would be in favor of greatly curtailing the federal judiciary, and if not, you know, the other thing that's mandated, of course, is the Supreme Court under the Constitution. You know, it says that Article 3 says that the lower courts can be established by Congress as Congress desires and so on, but they're not. The only constitutional court really is the Supreme Court, or the only one that's mandated by Congress, by the Constitution. So the rest could all be done away with. But what I was going to say is, if you're going to limit your the appointment of federal judges to those who understand and appreciate the purpose and reason for grand juries, citizen grand juries, would you probably wouldn't have you'd have very few appointments available for the federal judiciary, and that would shrink the size by itself. So you're going to have to go back to the law schools and get the law schools to be teaching these things, or otherwise educate the potential juror, the potential judges about this, well, so that they can know and understand it.
Well, you get the bingo of the day, because the law schools don't teach attorneys much about the grand jury. I stump them every time when very few know this power.
And law schools don't teach the Constitution, period.
Right, that's spooky too.
I gotta tell you that what I learned about the Constitution, I didn't learn in law school. I went through law school without ever reading the Constitution. I went through Constitution law class without ever reading the Constitution.
Wow, that's incredible.
They didn't teach the Constitution. All they did was they taught what the court said about the Constitution, and without ever actually studying the Constitution itself.
Wow. Well, let me ask you a question here about the Constitution, not the Constitution, which I dearly love, but would the Constitution Party support a rule in their platform or in their rules that to run for the Constitution on the Constitution Party ballot, a candidate must first pass a constitutional exam? Is that something you think the Constitutional Party would support?
I would think that they probably would. I mean, I don't know that that's ever been propounded, but knowing the sentiments of most of our members, I would think something like that would likely pass. I mean, let me say, first of all, except for the nomination of president and vice president, the National Party doesn't get involved in nominating candidates or putting forth candidates. Those are the only two that come out of the National Party. The rest are, we believe in states' rights also for the party structure, and so each state sort of makes up its own criteria. And some states have a very elaborate questionnaire that they go through with every candidate before they will accept them as a nominee of the party.
Well, that's great. The reason why I'm asking this is because, you know, I've talked with several people running for office, and some even come to the Tea Party, and I'll stand up, you know, and question and answer. It says, can you tell me Article 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights? And out of four or five different candidates I've asked, one of them got like a D-plus on the answer to that question. And I'm like, you people are going to be writing laws based on the Constitution, and you don't understand that the states created the federal government and the protection therein in Article 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights. You don't even understand. One guy came to my office, he's running for county supervisor, and I asked him, oh, the Constitution's a good idea. I didn't ask that. Do you know about Article 9 and 10? Well, no, I don't. Sir, let me straight up with you. You shouldn't even be running for office. If you don't know the Constitution, you shouldn't even be running for office. There's a guy, he's running because he knows this. I'm voting for him wholeheartedly.
Yeah,
but on the state level, of course, you should have a questionnaire about your own state constitution, and knowing that these people could actually go up the chain of command, you know, all the way up to a U.S. congressman or a senator, like, you know, people, they start out, a lot of DAs go into a supervisor and then an assemblyman or a representative of the state legislature. They're up the chain of command. That's kind of the time to catch them on the federal level. It's a talented exam, and so I agree with you on kudos to the many states that have quite the exam process to run on the ticket.
But hey, and, you know, to become a naturalized citizen, you have to pass a answer questions on the Constitution. and why shouldn't it be all that much more?
Not to run the country.
Right.
Exactly. So why shouldn't it be all that more important for somebody who's going to take an oath, they're going to place their hand on the Bible and swear that they're going to uphold the Constitution, and many of them have never even read it, so they don't even know what they're swearing to. How are they going to uphold it when they don't know what it says? So I think it's totally appropriate.
Well, or you know, when you say stuff like, when you guys talk about stuff like that, I just had this sickening in my heart that, you know, right there tells you 90% of why we're in the trouble we're in. That and lifetime, you know, lifetime politicians. Mm-hmm. I imagine Robert's going to tell us that we're running out of time.
Well, yes and no. We are definitely running out of live time for the live audience, but one good thing about this venue is there is a recording session after the live in which folks can listen to the archives afterwards, which those who are on the line, on the phone, can still talk and hear what's going on. Unfortunately, the folks who aren't, so whoever can stay and continue the conversation, that would be great. But since we only have 5 minutes left, and if you've got the questions on the Fed and the QE3, I think that you wanted to ask about, if Mr. Clymer can answer those and stay on, that would be great. If not, it's understood. But at this time is when I usually say thank you, everyone, for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk this evening, whether you came in from Blog Talk Radio or the Bard's Logic Political Talk website or some of the other venues in which you can listen to the show, or whether you have listened to this show on the archives. I want to thank you as well. And also thank you to the folks who have participated in the chat this evening. And, of course, we always hope to see you again. And I like to promote that tomorrow night we are hoping to have the free and equal debate piped in through Bard's Logic Political Talk tomorrow night, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. So we're hoping to have that in through tomorrow. Right now I don't see why that shouldn't happen. So that's what we're looking at for Tuesday night, which is tomorrow night. So we will continue on with the conversation. So, Mr. Clymer, if you can stick around for a little while, that'd be appreciated. And if not, we understand. So what would you like to do? The ball is in your court,
well,
sir.
Well, I'm an early riser. I'm up by 4:30 in the morning. My wife is going to think that I've been captured by aliens here pretty shortly.
No, I'm just kidding. Just joking,
if you have a question or two here quickly that I could deal with, I'll do that. But I would like to get going here pretty
in the next
4 or 5 minutes.
Understood.
Well, the other questions that I had written down, we had kind of covered anyway, but this is one that's been a major study of mine, and partly is because of your guys' fault, Dr. Paul's fault. Well, it's about the Fed. But it's even more, I listened to an interview with Lindsey Williams. I don't know if you've ever heard him talk, but he's been talking about this, our economic challenges coming for many years. He was a pastor, and he was a pastor, and he had some high-level connections in the oil industries and the banking industries and stuff, and he's really good at scaring the crap out of you, for lack of a better term, about what's going on in the world finances. And he had a little conversation about QE3, basically essentially saying what it is $40 billion a month the federal government is buying up all the land behind every mortgage in this country, so they will own all the property. And that is a plan, and it's not really going to help us financially. The big part of this, and I'll get your input on this, is he outlined all the trade deals that China has around the world this last year that they've enacted, whether it be China and India, China and Iran, China and Russia, China and South Africa, China and Brazil, China and you name it. They are set up to now circumnavigate and trade, no longer using the U.S. dollar. So Lindsey Williams is talking about all this unused trillions of U.S. dollars coming home unused, on top of this QE3 thing, on top of, you know, the Fed and the bankers and the international globalists all being part of this. He's like his alarm is going off big time. What's your input on all that? I know it's a long question.
Real quick, I've only got a minute here before the live shut down. I just want to ask folks to Rex and Tax Show on Blog Talk Radio. You can find them on Election 2012. They will be discussing the other debate that's nearly not as important as the one tomorrow night. But if you want to hear any commentary on that, go to the Tex and Rex Show. Thank you very much, guys. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a lot of insight on that. I just know that, I mean, I certainly agree with that. I'm not familiar with this Lindsay, what did you say his name? Lindsay
Williams.
Williams,
yeah.
But I have heard and read similar types of things. And when you have, whether it's the Fed or even the government, the ability to manipulate the currency and devalue and spend money that they don't have, create money out of thin air and do all that, it's just another tool for tyrannical government, for accruing power in the hands of a central government.